AMOCO, Amoco, American Oil Company, maker of famous Amoco products, presents the Edward R. Murrow Program with Charles Collingwood. You buy gasoline 5 or 10 gallons at a time, and you pay for it in nickels, dimes, and dollars. But the cost of gasoline can't be figured that way, for it's the cost per mile traveled that really counts. That's why motorists from Maine to Florida say that Amoco Gas, premium Amoco Gas, is the least expensive motor fuel you can buy. And that's because it's all petroleum. It can all burn. Amoco Gas, the original special motor fuel, can all turn to power and mileage. Mr. Murrow is on vacation. And now here is Charles Collingwood.
The Supreme Court will meet at noon tomorrow to consider the case of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg for what may be the last time. The convicted atomic spies are scheduled to die in the electric chair 10 hours after the court meets. Today, 36 hours before the moment of execution, Supreme Court Justice Douglas granted the Rosenbergs an indefinite stay. He made his decision on a technical point, whether the Rosenbergs were actually tried and convicted under the correct law. We have on our statute books a 1917 espionage law that provides the death penalty. This is the law under which the Rosenbergs were tried and convicted. But we also have the 1946 Atomic Secrets Act, which provides the death penalty only when a jury so recommends and when the crime of the defendants is proved to have been committed with intent to injure this nation. Now, in the Rosenberg trial, under the 1917 law, the jury did not recommend the death penalty, nor was there any special effort to prove that the defendants wanted to injure the United States. But Justice Douglas has accepted the argument that perhaps the Rosenbergs should have been tried under the new law. He points out that while it was passed before the Rosenbergs were tried, the indictment against the couple says they were engaged in their conspiracy both before and after the date the atomic law was passed. Mr. Justice Douglas did not rule on the guilt or innocence of the Rosenbergs. He merely says there is a substantial legal question that has not been brought before any court before. Soon after the Douglas decision was made known, Attorney General Brownell called it an unprecedented action, requested Chief Justice Vinson to reconvene the court that is adjourned for the summer to void the stay of execution granted by one of its 9 justices. 2 hours later, Chief Justice Vinson announced that the court will meet at noon tomorrow. At Sing Sing Prison, the Rosenbergs, who were saying their last farewells to family and friends, heard the news over the prison radio. A guard says they were very happy. I want to talk further about the Rosenberg case in a moment. The Chinese Communist Radio says their staff officers and ours have now drawn a ceasefire line in Korea. This would appear to be the last step before signing an armistice. There are reports in Washington, unofficial, that agree with the enemy version. And as if to confirm this, the Communists abruptly halted their attacks on the Korean front. All was quiet today except for occasional artillery duels and a few patrol clashes. The Eighth Army confirms a report that a large number of anti-communist prisoners of war broke out of one of our camps at Pusan today. There are a few details. Some correspondents suggest that the enemy may accuse the Allied command of deliberately releasing these prisoners who do not want to return home. The Pentagon says we suffered another 443 casualties in Korea last week. The list now reads 24,000 dead, almost 9,000 missing, almost 99,000 wounded, a total of 136,000 casualties in the war. The president told reporters at the White House today that we are firmly committed to help bring about a unified Korea, and he said fears that we will sell out the South Koreans in the truce are completely groundless. Mr. Eisenhower also brought up the situation in communist-controlled East Berlin, where some 50,000 persons staged a mass riot today. The president says the significant thing about this is that it disproves the communist story of how many happy people are behind the Iron Curtain. A few minutes ago, my colleague Richard C. Hotellet, who covered the riots in Berlin, recorded this report for you.
Tonight, East Berlin lies dark and deserted under Soviet martial law and a tight curfew. No one knows what will happen tomorrow. At 7 o'clock this morning, scores of thousands of workers, old and young, men and women, rallied in a driving rain to protest the work speed-up, hunger, and oppression. Many were just curious, astonished that this could happen. All had a deep anger in their bellies. I met the first phalanxes on Unter den Linden, marching 30 and 40 abreast, shouting, "We want free elections. Give us bread. Give us freedom or we'll kill the bigwigs." They shook their fists and shouted "Pui" at Soviet armored cars and motorized infantry which passed them on patrol. All the columns, groups, and stragglers converged on the Prime Minister's office in the center of town. On the way, they tentatively tore down a few propaganda posters. Nothing happened. Emboldened, they broke up a newsstand and a propaganda shed on the Potsdamer Platz, jeered at pictures of communist leaders, and set the whole thing on fire. They tore up the sector boundary markers to feed the flames, and still there was no interference by communist police or Soviet troops. Confidence rose to a new high, and there was one electric moment at 10 o'clock when 250,000 people met in front of the ministry building. A group of communist loyalists singing the Internationale was chased howling down the street, and the crowd roared its defiance and its demands to the windows above. With leaders and with weapons, the next step would have been revolution, but the moment passed. The crowd still milled around in spite of a heavy rain shower. It even staged a parade with improvised placards demanding free elections, cheered news that the trains had stopped in sympathy and that factory workers were marching in from the suburbs. But gradually the crowd thinned out. Some violence occurred here and there. Hapless party members had their badges ripped off and their noses punched. A few official limousines were set on fire, and Deputy Prime Minister Otto Nuschke kidnapped to West Berlin. Yet, when the Soviet commandant declared a state of emergency at 2 o'clock and sent his tank division clattering down the main streets, the crowds dispersed. Many collected along the sector boundary, hurling rocks and curses at the tanks and communist police behind them. The Reds replied with small arms and machine gun fire. At least 3 people were killed, and about 100 wounded are in West Berlin hospitals tonight. One thing seems certain as I speak. There will be no more mass demonstrations. The Russians are fully in control.
That was Richard C. Hotellet speaking from Berlin. At his White House news conference today, President Eisenhower was questioned by reporters who wanted amplification of his Dartmouth College speech in which he attacked book burners. For one thing, Mr. Eisenhower made it clear that he did not want to discuss personalities. This was his answer to a reporter who wanted to know if the president had Senator McCarthy in mind. Then the president amplified his views. He said the State Department is free to burn books which are outright communist propaganda, books that openly appeal for the communist way of life. The president said we don't have to be a party to our own self-destruction. That would be the acme of silliness. Mr. Eisenhower also told the reporters, this country must encourage a wide freedom of discussion, and in general, we should keep in our libraries abroad, the same books that we have on our shelves at home. Later, Senator McCarthy told reporters he feels the president has made a commendable clarification of his book burner speech. Mr. Eisenhower also revealed at his news conference that he has prepared a new order intended to promote a freer flow of news from the government to the people. It will cut from 45 to 16 the number of agencies that may stamp news as secret. The president also said, in answer to questions, that not once in his election campaign did he promise an immediate tax reduction. He said he held up lower taxes as a goal. Supreme Court Justice Clark today turned down an invitation to testify before a House committee about cases he handled when he was the government's attorney general. About the Rosenberg case, one can only imagine the torment of conscience that Justice Douglas went through last night as he made up his mind to postpone once again the execution of the Rosenbergs. No matter how learned in jurisprudence or how elevated in the judicial hierarchy he may be, a judge's most difficult decisions are those which involve the lives of human beings. The unusual nature of the Rosenberg case must have made that decision even more difficult. Not in our generation has there been a legal cause which brought into play such delicately balanced forces of emotion, moral conviction, and high public policy. For although Justice Douglas's decision was based on legal grounds, the importance of the Rosenberg case has come to transcend the purely legal questions involved. The Rosenbergs have become symbols, and their fate has become invested with profound symbolic importance. This is true in the United States, where, after a period of considerable public apathy, many people have become deeply stirred by the case. It is particularly true abroad, where protests against the infliction of the death penalty have risen to a degree where they've become a very important consideration in our foreign policy. The depth of this feeling is apparent in the fact that the President of France took the unprecedented step of letting President Eisenhower know that he hoped the Rosenberg's death sentence could be commuted. 3 former premiers of France have likewise urged clemency. Important figures in most European countries have made similar representations. The Pope himself took notice of the tide of protest. All this is over and above the organized communist drive to use the Rosenberg case for their own ends. The communists have exploited the situation in the most cynical fashion. But, as so often happens, they were able to touch a wellspring, a reservoir of very deep emotions. Any death sentence runs counter to the moral principles of many people. The death sentence for peacetime espionage strikes an even larger number as excessive. But the widespread revulsion against death for the Rosenbergs is not solely based on humanitarian grounds. One of the attitudes we have to contend with abroad is the theory that the adamant American position toward Russia is increasing world tension. To people who feel thus, the Rosenberg case has come to symbolize what they think of as the excessive fanaticism of American policy. So the Rosenbergs have become all tied up with the complicated attitude which other peoples of the world have toward American leadership. So much so that it's become a significant factor in the difficult decisions which President Eisenhower and the Supreme Court justices have had to make and now must make again. Their first concern must be the security of the United States. Among non-communists everywhere, there is little doubt that the Rosenbergs are guilty. The real question now is the harshness of the penalty, not only whether the punishment fits the crime, but whether the quest for national security will be helped or hindered by the Rosenbergs' execution. The matter is dragged on so long now as the Rosenbergs have skillfully used every device of the careful Anglo-Saxon legal system for delay that a decision is immensely more difficult to reach. If the Supreme Court allows Justice Douglas's decision to stand, it will drag on even longer. But the decision must be made. It will not be easy to make. Most of us can be glad that we don't have to make it. This is Charles Collingwood in New York. I'll be back in a moment with a footnote to the news. But first, Bob Dixon.
There are a lot of new magazines devoted to automobiles, and a lot of the things you read in them have to do with the cars of the future. It's quite an interesting subject, not just for the new styling ideas, but more importantly, the engine developments we can expect to see in the next 10 years. Think of the special lubrication problems these engines of the future will have. But the answer to those problems is here today. Right now, your Amoco man has a new motor oil designed with tomorrow's cars in mind. It's the new Permalube motor oil. So new, so advanced, it's the oil of the future. It has greater protection against acids, better lubricating action, more cleaning power. And you don't have to wait for the cars of the future to get the advantages of this oil of the future. No matter what car you drive, whether it's a 1953 model or a 1937 model, it will run a lot better and last a lot longer with new Permalube motor oil in the crankcase. Tell your Amoco man to drain the old oil from the crankcase and fill it with new Permalube motor oil, the oil of the future. That's my word for today, and here's Charles Collingwood with his footnote to the day's news.
This is the story of a man and his dog, a big gray German shepherd named Stark. Stark belonged to the 8th Army's Scout Dog Platoon, and for more nights than Max Myers of Greenwood, Nebraska cares to recall, he and Stark went out on patrol in Korea. Max now has his discharge, but Stark is still in the dog platoon, but not forgotten. Civilian Myers has asked the Army to give Stark an honorable discharge, too, proving that, on occasion, a man can be a dog's best friend. This is Charles Collingwood. See you later.
Think of the demands that tomorrow's cars will make on motor oils. Tolerances will be closer. Piston speeds will be higher. But the motor oil designed with those cars in mind, the motor oil especially developed to solve all their lubricating problems, is here today, ready for your own car right now. It's the new Permalube motor oil, so new, so advanced, it's literally the oil of the future. Give your engine its advantages. Change to new Permalube motor oil. This is the CBS Radio Network.